Hello and welcome back to Module 7, the last module for today.
Yep.
This is Exam 70484, Essentials for Developing Store Apps in C# and XAML. Can I say it? I won't say it again.
And I think you managed to find seven ways of saying that title.
I rearrange it. Just flows like magic.
And exactly.
Module 6, Darren, we were talking about architecture and some of the patterns and strategies that people use. Before we get back to that, I guess I need to do this little housekeeping thing.
Exactly.
First of all, there is an MVA code that you might enjoy having. And let's see. Let's see if I can find that. It'll be the
MVA C ESS.
Yep, ESS C refresh. And you can get your MVA points for that. Second of all, look right below the video. There is an INSAT poll right there that you can take. And we are one perfect vote away from making a record. So if you can be the one that can give us that perfect vote, this will be an all-time record for Microsoft Virtual Academy. I'm pretty excited about the whole thing. All right, there's all that business. Let's go on to what we were talking about. Windows Store apps, we were talking about basically storage strategies.
Yep.
And then just quickly about that loop back and the kind of throws people off.
Yeah, so those people who may have just joined or started this particular video, if you look at the previous video, then we talked about the strategy section, and we're not going to revisit that.
There's a link right here. You see it? Go ahead and just click that.
If you want to show my slides, please. So yes, we covered the strategies column, and now we're going to move on and talk about patterns.
Okay, patterns. Patterns as in design patterns.
Yeah,
software
architectural
design
patterns.
Yeah. A lot of people have heard of patterns. I mean, honestly, especially newer developers, they've heard of patterns but may not appreciate a pattern in general. And mm-hmm. So just so we have a familiarity and a kind of a level set of dictionary words here, mm-hmm. What is a pattern? What's a pattern to you?
So a pattern to me is really a named example that solves a problem. Mm. So, the Gang of Four, Grady Booch and co., really codified a set of foundational patterns for building software. You know, things like singletons and all those kind of things. And what they really did was they helped us as developers and architects have a consistent vocabulary on how we talked about a particular problem and a solution to that problem.
Yeah.
And those things became implemented in all manner of different languages. But, you could talk across languages and still say, hey, a singleton is a singleton is a singleton.
Yeah. So you're saying, first of all, that a pattern isn't necessarily restricted to a single technology.
Nope.
But it also gives us a way of talking to one another mm-hmm. without constantly having to describe the concept. It's a
yeah.
name to the concept.
Exactly. It's much in the same way as the design guidelines for app store applications position you to have a consistent visual vocabulary and a consistent set of contracts and things that you implement in your application.
Right.
Patterns for software design, patterns for enterprise architecture, such as Martin Fowler put together in his book and so on, they allow us to have these building blocks.
Yeah.
And we can assemble these things consistently to create tried and true solutions to known problems that arise time and time again in our applications.
Yeah, so I like the way you said it at the very beginning. This is a solution, not mm-hmm. necessarily the solution.
Yep.
And so there could be several patterns. They aren't necessarily competing with each other. There are reasons to pick one or the mm-hmm. other depending on different scenarios. So for me to walk into an existing project, for example, and realize they're using pattern A, mm-hmm. and I am a big fan of pattern B, it doesn't mean pattern A was wrong. It's what they happen to choose. It may
yeah.
have some deficiencies, and we could address those. It may actually be better. It's just a different type of solution. Now, when we're talking about XAML applications, there are a handful of patterns that always come up again and again and again, mm-hmm. partly because I think they're good solutions.
Yeah. And they're trying to solve specific problems. And a lot of the patterns that we use are there to provide things like encapsulation, to defend against brittle code, mm-hmm. to defend against these huge slabs of monolithic code that are all stuck within, say, a code behind.
Yep.
Whereas, you're reusing those same things throughout your application. Are you cut and pasting those? Are you then introducing a maintenance problem
right.
by having the same code duplicated that when you find a bug in one of them, You've got to remember all the places you copied it to actually fix those bugs and so on.
You're right. Let's create categories of apps. Mm-hmm. There's two. Let's create just two to keep it simple.
Yeah.
The first one is sort of the small little hobbyist sort of app. It's sort of a do it and throw it away. It's something you'll
maybe it's investigating a particular concept or idea. Mm-hmm. You know, where the application architecture itself is not important, but you're proving, oh, can I do this with the camera?
Yeah, that's right. And you get to the feature that you want. You may still even put it in the store, to be mm-hmm. honest. But you probably will never come back to it, and even if you do, it's only for trivial reasons. But then we also have this other type of application. Maybe in order to even get it done, it's going to take a significant amount of time, perhaps more than one person.
Mm-hmm.
And odds are it's going to need maintenance in the future. You may or you may not be the one doing the maintenance.
Yep.
So we have this sort of encapsulated app, and then we have this big app.
Yes.
Right? Bigger, let's just say. It doesn't have to be a gigantic line of business multi-million dollar app.
Mm-hmm.
And the line between them is really the decision on how much architecture you're going to introduce.
Yes.
And, of course, in this hobbyist app, we kind of see it. There's two of those as well.
Yes.
There is the, you've asked me to get this done. I got it done. It's in the store. Everything's great. Done. But then there's also this artistic approach.
Mm-hmm. Oh, craftsman-based.
Craftsman-based. I'm a developer, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of proud of the work that I do. And I go in, and I don't put in a bunch of spaghetti junk. I actually do hard work, and I actually mm-hmm. lay it out properly.
Yeah, you know, and there's a certain kind of satisfaction in building something that you feel is well-architected, that follows certain architectural patterns and guidelines, and you realize the benefit as you move through it. That feels good. It's like, I'm glad I pulled this service mm-hmm. out, because now, as I think about it, I need to add an extra set of screens or pages to my application, and I can use it, and it's just bang, bang, bang.
It's sort of why developers work all night long. It's because they like it, and this is an example of what you would do because you like it. Now, as far as performance, which one of those two gets it done? They both get it done,
both get it done.
Both fully functional, and there's kind of an ironic side to this, that the sloppy implementation potentially could outperform one with full architectural implementation.
Because, excuse me, if you go down the path of leveraging things like dependency injection, you know, contract-based development, mm-hmm. Abstractions, separation of concerns, all these kind of things, then you can end up with more code, more scaffolding,
those
more infrastructure.
Those are not free.
Yeah.
They are not free. They certainly contribute back to things. And so the reality is I have either one, and that performance delta we're talking about now is a potential trivial number, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about milliseconds, and it may not matter.
Yeah.
But one is done just to get it over with. The other's done because you're proud of it at the end. But then over at the side is a full-fledged app that has maintenance. And you have a certain responsibility as a developer and designer to make sure your application doesn't have to be rewritten every time somebody needs a change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's sort of the scope of it all, whether or not to have patterns, from no patterns to perfect patterns to patterns that are correct for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about some patterns inside XAML.
Yeah.
The most common one we talk about is?
View model.
View model, absolutely. The model view model is basically saying there are three pieces inside your application that you'll use over and over again. The view is simply your XAML, right?
And so. And the code behind.
And the code behind. In fact, that's an important piece. It is not just your XAML.
Yeah.
It's the XAML and code behind and all the code you need, basically, to get the user interactions satisfied. So mm-hmm. Storyboards and anything else that might be visual state transitions and anything else like that that you might need to make the UI part or in the UX part of your application successful.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the, and before we go to view model, we have the view, but then on the other side we have the model.
Yep.
And what's a model?
So a model, it tends to represent some form of object that your application is dealing with. It is shaped for the object
mm-hmm.
and the properties that the object has. It's shaped for the behaviors that the object may exhibit. So, for example, let's talk about a customer. Mm-hmm. So name, address, all these things could be elements of that customer. You could have a preferred customer. You could have methods on there that validate whether that customer is a valid customer. You could have methods that interact with the history associated with that customer and so on. There is a lot of behaviors that are unique to that customer.
Now, at its fundamental level, the customer is a class.
It's a class. It's an object instance.
It's an object instance.
And it could be representative of an external data source, such as a database,
could be
a service.
Represent a table of customers, and this is a single record.
Yep. It could be an aggregation of many other objects that could be very, very complex.
Yeah. In the end, a model is data. And your view is the UI. Then so we have this thing that combines them. The view certainly doesn't know how to go get a model, and the model doesn't, I hope, know how to talk to a view. So there's this bridge in between that we refer to as the view model. And the view model is just another class that knows how to talk to a model and knows how to speak to a view.
And it does a number of very key things. It can shape the data that's available in a model or more than one model.
That's right.
For presentation specific to a view. So, you know, you might have a model that has 20,000 properties.
Yeah.
That would be unfortunate, but you may.
Yep.
You don't need all of those. You certainly don't want all of those on your screen.
That's right.
And so you can take that and project that into a perspective, a view, to use the SQL sort of definition of
kind
a view.
Kind of a simpler model.
Exactly. To simplify it for presentation in that particular view. Same way as it can also, as you say, broker and manage the communication between the presentation and the persistence.
Right. So now there is a, if we were to go into this pattern a little more, the view knows about the view model, and the view model knows it's going to be used by the view, but it doesn't have a reference to the view. That's because we want to be able to take that view model, take it out of our project if we wanted to, put it into a separate project if we want to. That way we could test it, run unit tests against it, or anything else we want. Not necessarily for reuse purposes. This is purely for reuse into a test and just testing it.
It's to provide robust validation that your application logic is intact as you make progressive changes through your system's lifecycle.
That's right. And we know there's a reality that you may not write those unit tests. Is there still a value in having it abstracted away from the view if you don't test it and you don't take it out and put it into a separate project? So all I do is put it into a separate folder in the same project. Is it still worth having a view model against my view?
I personally think it is. The reason being is it helps you encapsulate what you're trying to do. It's very easy if you're trying to throw all of it into a code behind that you get a lot of code sitting in there that kind of merges in together and becomes harder and harder to maintain. I like to use a view model of really to aggregate some of these other patterns that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Starts pulling in services, starts pulling in commands and so on and so forth that we'll touch on in a moment. And it becomes that centralized sort of connection between the two systems.
I think it's important too that even if you aren't doing it for testing and for removing into another project and abstracting it like that, if you ever had to, you could, right? You haven't made it so it's impossible in the future. So you've gone ahead and done things the same every way, or every time. You know, it's always the same way. It's always the same. I wonder where the logic is for this view. I'll bet it's in the view model because that's the way we always do things. And so you can go to the view model for it.
And, you know, often applications grow beyond our original intent. You know, we start with an idea and we develop it over time. And it's very, very annoying to have to go back and refactor a whole bunch of spaghetti code into a pattern now because you realize, oh, I need to maintain this because you know, this nutty little app that I put out in the store, all of a sudden I've got 100,000 users and gee, I wish I'd done a better job.
A view model does introduce a level of complexity, but it actually reduces a level of complexity too by making sure that everything's in the same place and doing it the same way. Again, this is just a class. It just has properties. It just has methods. It just has events. Nothing else. This isn't something special. It's just a place to put the logic that interacts with your your view.
Now, students of patterns may turn around and say, well, this sounds very much like Model View Presenter. And really the primary difference between Model View Presenter and the MVVM is data binding, is the fact that data binding allows our view model to be completely unaware of the controls that are consuming the data. And so that's really what necessitated an evolution of the MVP pattern into what became known as the Model View View Model.
And Model View View Model came into existence when WPF was released. I mean, these really are friends with each other. It's the reason we see it so often. And we're not really explaining how to do it. We're just talking about what it is and why it might be valuable. One of the things you see with the MVVM pattern over and over again is commanding.
Mm-hmm.
And commanding is our ability to go to an interactive control, such as a button, and use that, have that interactive control talk to the view model without wiring it up, mm-hmm. and creating some sort of something or other in the code behind.
Yeah, and effectively, to use the button as an example, one of the in the examples that we've shown throughout the day, we've used the click event.
Yeah.
And so we associate a method with the click event, we create a method in the code behind that takes an object sender, it takes a routed event args,
yeah.
and in there we do some work. That doesn't necessarily have access to the data. It can have access to the data by going into the data context and pulling out and casting and so on and so forth. But if we've got a view model,
yeah.
you know, the data is encapsulated within the view model, so should all the behavior on that data. So we could, and in fact, I think in one of the examples we did, get a reference to our view model and then invoke a method. I think it was in the search box.
That's right.
In the search box, we invoked an event in the code behind, then we invoked a method on the view model. So you could do that, and that's how you would do it if you didn't have access to commands.
Now, let me pause you here, because I think this is where it's important to say, and that's not wrong.
No.
Right? The thing about model view model is it's meant to make your app more maintainable, more testable, easier to follow, less complex, but it's not here to tell you how model view model is supposed to be done.
Yeah.
Every developer might have a slight variation depending on the context and situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that I mean, there isn't a purist. If there's an MVVM purist, then they're wrong, right? Mm-hmm. There is no purist approach to MVVM. There are just really good practices that you should consider.
Yeah. To give you an example, I mean, you can spend a long time trying to create some sort of infrastructure between your presentation layer if you're just doing it exclusively in XAML,
yeah.
you know, with attached properties,
right.
and so on and so forth, to try and wire in a connection through data binding. If you're spending all that time doing it,
mm-hmm.
maybe you should find an easier way.
Right, because you're actually growing complexity now,
yeah.
by trying to reduce complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it can be done doesn't mean necessarily, yeah. that should be done, because that's painful, right?
Yeah. The flip side of it is, maybe that's a worthwhile investment to simplify the development for a significant team or a significant application.
Right.
That you as an architect may be able to understand how to implement this, and you can prescribe to the remainder of your team,
yeah.
that you will integrate to this back-end capability via this attached property. Bang, done. Makes it very simple for everybody else.
Yeah, I think that most people are timid to come into a MVVM pattern because they feel like everybody who already knows it,
mm-hmm.
is going to look at their implementation and
judge it
and laugh. Mm-hmm. But you know, unlike other patterns, which are very prescriptive, MVVM is a little softer, and I think it's almost more welcoming in a way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So, but I will say, not to use it would be a mistake.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely vital that you consider a pattern. There is this idea of architectural debt.
Mm-hmm.
That, again, we're back to the hobbyist. You have this little tinker toy that you're making. You're not going to get into very much architectural debt, but you go into a line of business app or just a larger app that might succeed. Architectural debt becomes very expensive, and the concept is the farther you go without any architecture, without any patterns that you're using,
mm-hmm.
The harder it is to go back and put them in.
Yep. So we should actually talk about implementing the commanding pattern. Mm-hmm. So the framework provides an interface that defines a command, iCommand.
iCommand, yeah.
But by default, if you just create a blank application, there isn't an implementation of iCommand.
No, that's right. Coincidentally, if you create any of the other templates, like
mm-hmm.
The grid or split or hub,
yep.
it does insert or put in a file called relay command into the common folder.
Mm-hmm.
And that relay command is an implementation of iCommand.
Yeah.
Not the kind of implementation I do when
mm-hmm.
I do my own relay command, to be honest. It's missing
yep.
some things, but it certainly gets you down the road. If
yeah.
you look at a library like MVVM Lite, they
mm-hmm.
also have a relay command, which actually is the way I do mine. It's,
yes.
it's excellent.
Yeah.
And so you could go into MVVM Lite, for example, use their entire framework,
mm-hmm.
and you're good to go. Or you could go and just pick out their relay command.
A couple of things. Yeah, absolutely. And so you know, you have a command attribute on a button,
mm-hmm.
and you also have command parameters on your button.
Built right into XAML, ready to support this.
Yes. And so one of the extensions to relay command is typically a typed generic
yeah.
Relay command that allows you to pass around specific parameters into your command, such as, say, for example, you'd attached to a selection. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to get the selected object and pass it into your command, so it's executed as part of that command.
So that the command doesn't do something generic, it does something specific to mm-hmm. the type of data you're passing to it.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have that command property. And a lot of developers get thrown off because they see that they have a command on a button and it's perfect and we'll race through the rest. They have a command on a button, but then they look at a list with like a selection changed.
Yep.
And they're like, ah, good, another opportunity to use my command. There is no command on it. That's just an event that's raised. And so, as a result, we have these things that have come up all over the internet. Event to command. It's just a class that listens for an event that you specify and raises executes the command that you specify on the other side. Mm-hmm. Now with Visual Studio 2013, using Blend, we have event triggers, a type of behavior, and then we also have an invoke command action that attaches to that, which is basically our event to command built into Visual Studio now.
Yeah.
So if you want to use commanding, but you don't want to use more than a button, you can use behavior to do it, and it totally makes sense. One thing you get for free on a button, though, is that a command won't execute if it can't execute.
Yes.
And so you give it some sort of logic, it's up to you, whether or not it's allowed to execute. You can't, for example, save data if all the fields aren't there, something like that. And so it returns a false, and the button, the save button, is disabled. It's really nice. And what's cool is I might have a button here, 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 and here that all say save. They all get disabled at once because in the end, they're just projections.
If they're using the same command.
Of that one command.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the commanding. We also have this idea of messaging. And it kind of goes back to there is a risk of holding something in memory, right? Mm-hmm. That's where messaging comes from.
Yeah.
Once you do a reference.
Yeah, and so, you know, messaging is somewhat different from events. The difference, events, the subscriber to an event needs to have a reference to the originator of an event, and so they become tightly coupled.
Yeah.
Messaging allows us to have loosely coupled communication between objects that actually aren't aware of each other. Mm-hmm. And what they tend to share is a message broker or some form of message bus that the producer or the publisher of a message tells the message bus, hey, this is the message I'm pushing into you.
Yeah.
And that's it. Job done.
And we talked about this in our C# course, where, so I have two classes. This one is waiting for an event to be raised up here. And that event does or doesn't happen, it doesn't matter. And then I move out of this class and I set it to null or whatever. And then I create another one of it. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, it's still there, shadowed in the background.
Hold on.
Because this is what's holding the reference to it. And this is what we're solving with messaging.
Yes, especially if we're implementing weak references. So if our message bus then turns around and provides the ability for other classes or object instances to subscribe to a given message, that manages passing the message from the publisher to the subscriber.
Mm.
And so again, you know, the publisher doesn't know anything about the subscriber doesn't know anything about the publisher.
So the logic that I use to interact with services and charms and contracts inside Windows 8 is a repetitive pattern as well. And let's just talk about settings alone, right? That's something that everybody's application is going to use. Navigation would be another awesome one. The logic I write for that, I'm going to write over and over and over again. I'd like a way to abstract that out so that it's not built into my view model. It's not built into my anything. It's just something I call out to, and all the hard work has been done once. So that is a service, basically a wrapper around a repetitive feature.
Yeah, and the other nice thing about that is, again, coming back to testability, we can create a contract that our navigation service implements.
Or an interface, like I service something.
Exactly. And we could create a test implementation of that that actually doesn't require a running application with a true frame to do navigation and so on. And we can actually inject into that and say, okay, say that you cannot navigate back. And then we can test to ensure that the behaviors of that view model are correct for that scenario.
So I write a service that is for navigation. It's an iNavigation service. It's not a real navigation service at all. It's faking it. It's totally pretending as if it can and can't navigate, all based on the unit tests that I'm running.
Yeah. And that then brings us to, how do we consume these services and, in fact, view models and so on? And that kind of brings us to kind of the factory or locator pattern.
Yeah.
So that we can create a single place where we go and pull forward. You know, give me the navigation service for my application. Yeah. Give me the settings service for
Again,
my application.
Again, this is just a class with properties, and these are the properties
Fancy
we
names,
go to.
But they're just classes and
so
properties.
So the class is called service locator, has a property called navigation service. Mm-hmm. This what you were just talking about, the navigation service, still instantiated over there and has all of its logic. And then the locator goes and finds it for me. Mm-hmm. So my again, it takes all the logic away from my view model so it doesn't have to have so much repetitive code.
Indeed.
And also, that's where I would do my mocking as well.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked about strategies of how we're thinking about data. We've talked about patterns and how we can build things. What about stuff we can use to accelerate our development?
Yeah. So this here we are in the third column. And this one is just stuff that developers use, and it's really, really handy.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the Windows Live SDK that comes from Microsoft. You don't use this for authentication, although you can. Mm-hmm. Right? This is really where authentication started, to use the Microsoft account. That way I can get the name, picture, email of the user that's logged in. Very nice, but it also gives me access to their SkyDrive, mm-hmm. also gives me access to their mail if they provide it, mm-hmm. also gives me access to their calendar if they provide it. That's very powerful.
Yeah.
That's what I would do with the Windows Live SDK. If I needed SkyDrive, I would start here. There really is no other way. The SkyDrive API, as you and I know, is a little tricky.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yep. Then we'll visit that in the advanced session.
Yeah, we will. Then there's WAMS, Windows Azure Mobile Services. So mobile services is that free service. You get 10 mobile services. It's 10 unique endpoints, I guess is the best way to think about it, mm-hmm. that can do push notifications, scheduled operations on the server, as well as talk to a database that's up there as well. Yeah. So a lot of nice things you can do with WAMS, and it's free from Microsoft. And you can also use it in concert with the 10 websites that you could get mm-hmm. and have full WCF services if you wanted to.
The other thing that we can do on top of that is we have the notification hub capability as part of Azure, which actually allows us to have multi-platform notification services running out of one service.
Yeah.
So you know, if you're a product vendor and you're targeting both Windows Phone, Android, and you know, the iPhone, then you can actually use that as a single notification service that can actually send out notifications across all the platforms.
If you wanted to build your app so that the user could log into LinkedIn, or you wanted to build it so they could log into Google, mm-hmm. or you wanted to use it so they could log into Twitter or Microsoft account, all four of those are aggregated to a single set of APIs inside the WAMS SDK.
Yeah.
So that's really the way to do it. If you're wondering, like, I've got to do all this work, all that work is actually done for you inside WAMS. Just download the SDK and implement authentication through that. That's the reason earlier I said you wouldn't necessarily use the Windows Live SDK for authentication. That's because really WAMS is the go-to way to do it. Then there's the multilingual toolkit, and we'll show this off a lot more tomorrow, but I think it's worth at least calling out today that that's a free download from us, and it uses the translation service inside Bing to use all of your strings inside your application and translate them to a target language that you
choose. Do have to obviously approach your string resources in a specific way.
Right.
You know, it's not just going to magically find every string literal in your application and convert
it.
That would be unfortunate.
It would be awesome and terrible at the same time.
Exactly, yeah. So you have to use resources, string resources, and so on. And as Jerry mentions, we'll cover that in more depth in the advanced curricula.
But it is there, and it's free to you. And you can, you know, I have a URL, aka.ms/w8tools, where most of this actually exists.
Yep.
AKMSW8tools. So then there's the advertising SDK. So to monetize your app, you're going to make money somehow. Maybe you won't, but let's say you do. Mm-hmm. You could sell your app, or it's for free. Mm-hmm. You could give your app away for free as a trial, and then you could sell something inside your app to turn off the trial. It's an in-app purchase. Or you could give your app for free. Anyway, you could sell something inside your app, sell your app itself, or everything is free, and I've got advertisements. Where do you get advertisements? You can get it from Microsoft Advertising using PubCenter. That's the advertising SDK. And it's beautiful, built right into Visual Studio 2013. It's easy to use. We'll show it off tomorrow. And but there's also the Ad Rotator for Windows 8. And there's also Ad Rotator for Windows Phone as well. Because the reality is, no matter who you're using to serve up advertisements, there's a concept of fill rates. Mm-hmm. And the fill rate means whether or not you even get an ad. Because depending on the country you're in, the time of day, the content, whatever it is, you'll ask for an advertisement and they may not have one to provide you. And so you have some percentage of the actual fill rate. You only get paid when you show an advertisement. So what do you do to mitigate that problem? Use the ad rotator to go use, let's say, ad duplex or another service out there. So you have several different accounts and it slowly falls through each of them until you find one that works. Or you could potentially use an in-house advertisement.
Yep. Sounds good.
Other features you can add, and again, most of these are free, which is what's so great about them, is you can use the Bing Maps SDK. You can use that not just to show maps, which is certainly valuable. You can use it to route people using give them directions, right? And you can also use it for imagery. You can go get the imagery if you want to.
You can layer in your own custom layers on top of that.
That's right. If you need to draw a polygon on a map, you can go ahead and do that. Show where your fleet of cars is and keep them moving around the map. Really nice. Anyway, it's right there for you. And again, it's free as well.
Yep.
A lot of these are free to a threshold, where if after you use them for a million clicks or whatever, then you have to pay something.
Of course. That's often a nice problem to have.
Yeah. Now, free, this is free if you have Visual Studio. This isn't an SDK or anything like that. This is just a tool that all store developers have and probably should use. And it's the ability to use remote tooling inside Visual Studio.
Yes. And there's a specific scenario in app store development where you want to make sure that your app runs well on an ARM device, such as Windows RT. Right. And you can install the remote tools for ARM onto your Surface and actually run and debug it from your main machine.
Right, so I have my app running on my main machine, like you said. I have it debugging on my main machine.
Exactly.
But it's running on my Surface, and no special cables or anything like that.
Yeah, works across Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It really
does work, too. It's really astounding.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a great way to... First, you would run it not debugging, right? You could just deploy it and run it, see how you like it. You have a problem because it's on the ARM. Now you can step through and find it out.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice. The last one, and this one's not a Microsoft one at all. It's the marked up SDK. And it's just one of many possible things you could add, obviously. But the marked up SDK is an instrumentation API. Instrumentation, which feeds to telemetry. So here's a couple new words for us, but the idea around instrumentation is every time the user clicks purchase on your app, every time the user clicks search on your app, every time the user, all the things that might matter, you don't want to overdo it, every time the user moves their mouse isn't the right thing, but every time the user does something that's core inside your app, you might want to write back just a little log so that you know that it happened. All of that is instrumentation, writes back to the log, and it aggregated together, that's your telemetry that allows you to see, are people even using my app? And when they do, are they having trouble? Are they using what I think they're using? Are they using it
what
in
are the
order?
Key features? You know, and this helps you strategically determine what you should be investing in your application as you enhance it.
That's right.
You know, I've got an area of the app that nobody is using. Is that because it's bad? Is it because, you know, it's not usable? It doesn't have valid or fresh data, you know, do I spend time enhancing that to gain more usage there, or do I invest in the areas that people are really using, add more content to it, and so on and so forth?
Yeah.
It's very useful.
But lots of developers don't go this route. They don't put in instrumentation, don't have any telemetry for their application, and they are just blind. They have no idea. I don't mean they're blind, I just mean they're blind to what their application's success
is. So a lot of the applications that we build for external companies, this is how they determine the ROI, the return on their investment for the application, is seeing engagement, seeing if people are going and looking at specific content and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's very much a key skill to be able to employ.
Nice. Okay, so that's a kind of a whirlwind tour of some architectural discussions. And I think to close up the day, I'd like to take our two-note, MVA Scratchpad application, prepare it for the store and go ahead and put it into the store so everybody can see what it's like. There are several steps, but I think watching somebody put it together will really be nice. So let me pull up that application here in Visual Studio. It's sitting here and ready to go. And it's completely ready. So there's really nothing for me to do to the app other than just build it and be done with it. So it's easiest to use all the menus that are around to get this over. So let me move some things out of the way so that we don't get confused in any way. All right, MVA Scratchpad is the app. It's a Windows 8.1 application. So I'll go to the Project tab. I think that's the easiest way to get started. I can go down to Store, and this will guide me through several steps. And the first one is capturing a screenshot. So when I do finally submit an app to the store, it's going to have a screenshot or two, up to eight screenshots, to help me see you know, what is it I want to do? So I select it. It gives me a dialog that says, hey, I'm about to launch this in the simulator. Of course, mm-hmm. the simulator is just a remote desktop back to my own installation of Windows here. But there it is. Everything's set to the right size.
Yep.
Now I can capture it. There's a little button right here. It looks like a camera. I'll go ahead and click it, and that puts it into a folder in my Photos folder. Mm-hmm. Easy enough. Done. I might take another, you know, scroll a couple places, show a couple features here and there, but in this case, we won't.
Yeah.
Did you know that there is a command bar at the bottom? And I can hit minus, and it uses a flyout on that button. Lists all the ones that
Strangely
are there.
Strangely, I did, because I think I wrote it.
Yeah, there's a handful of features. It's not just, this is almost three note. All right. So back to project. I've done the first step, and that's just creating a screenshot. Has to be at 1366 by 768. That's the only requirement. Now I'm going to create the app package. It's easy enough. I'll say create app package. It says yes or no. Are you going to create it for the store? The reason is I could say no here and give it to you to sideload on your app, mm-hmm. on your device, which is really nice. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go ahead and say yes. And when I do, it'll ask me to log in. So I'll log in as my little dummy account here, which is TPEUSW. And so let's see if this guy works. There he is. Oh, okay. Now, just like before, I have this authentication that's waiting.
Means you need to turn your phone on.
Uh-oh. Need to stall because my phone was turned off.
Quick, let's turn to the... Let's bring up LOLcats.
That's right. Let's do it this way. I'm going to go here anyway. So I'll go ahead and go to dev.windows.com. This is how I go to the developer's site and the dashboard where I would submit an app. So I'll have to do this no matter what. So here I'll just click on dashboard at the top. It'll navigate me to where it is that I need to go. I'm logged in as the correct user here. And so I have, let's see, I have the one that you created, this demo, Jumpstart Demo 1 mm-hmm. this morning. That's fun. So this is going to be Windows 8.1 Jumpstart. It's interesting that it has the icon. Oh, you know what? I know why. It doesn't matter now. All right. So it's completely not ready. This is just reserving the name, just like you did for Jumpstart Demo mm-hmm. 1. So I'll go into Edit for now. And you can see there's a series of steps that I absolutely must go through mm-hmm. in order to submit my app. So I'll start with the first one where it's asking me what I'm going to sell my app for. So in this case, we know it's worthwhile. Yeah. And since we're competing with OneNote, I think $9.99 makes sense to me.
I think it expresses the premium value that this application will deliver.
Exactly. I could make it free, of course, or I could give it a trial period. And so I could say, for example, this is $9.99 with a trial period that never expires.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you could play.
So if you paid $9.99, sucker.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome, isn't it? So now it's up to me of where I'm going to sell it, which markets I want to make this available in. This mm-hmm. might be a big deal because some markets I may not have especially a game that's appropriate for that. So I'll go ahead and say all markets, and then as I scroll down, it'll ask me when I want to release it. I want to release it as soon as it's available. That's probably not realistic for a real app. Mm-hmm. A real app would probably say, well, you're going to get done this week probably, certifying my app. I don't want it to be released until, let's say, December 1st, mm-hmm. because we're going to have a big party, and we're going to have lots of marketing, and it's going to be a big to-do. And so we wouldn't say, just go get it. Okay.
And equally, you might be producing some sort of marketing application that needs to coincide with a specific event. So the other key thing here is to plan your application publishing, because this does take time.
It does.
It can take up to, what, a week?
5 days, yeah. It can take up to 5 days to get a rejection. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because then you have another 5 day turnaround to try one more time. All right, now it's asking which category it goes into. This is just for visibility inside the store.
Yeah. Productivity?
I'm going to say lifestyle.
Oh.
Once you're organized, you're a different kind of person.
Okay.
And then you can pick the subcategory, which there is none at this time.
Okay.
And then we can go on down and say, does it have any special features or hardware requirements? We didn't do too much of anything. Is it accessible? Not at all.
No.
So we're not going to check that either. I'll go ahead and say save and be done with the second section of my app here. Now I'll go into services, and this is asking whether or not we use push notifications, mm-hmm. if we use live services, or if we have any sort of in-app purchase. So mm-hmm. we don't have any in-app purchase. There's really nothing for me to do here except acknowledge that I've been here. So I'll go ahead and click save, and now the third step will be done for me. So now I can go into the fourth one where I'm saying who the target audience is. This is going to be whether or not it's for children or what age I'm going to shoot mm-hmm. for. In this case, I would say a 7-year-old would benefit a lot from this. You know, honestly, I'm going to go on down to 3. But it's worth saying that we don't have any advertising in this, right?
Yeah.
If we were going to put advertising in it, it would immediately have a rating of 12 and over. So advertising, because you can't control what advertisements are going to be in there. You can kind of guide them, but you can't control them. So I'm going to go ahead and say 3 plus because we don't have any, I mean, it's, you know, it's real straightforward. Yeah. Now, I pick the age rating, and it's up to me. They will verify whether or not it's blatantly wrong, but they won't do much of a check against
yeah.
that. Then right here, I have the game definition. So I might have a game where I'm killing a bunch of zombies, you know, blowing up a bunch of whatevers, and some countries don't allow those sorts of apps, yeah. period. And
Zombieland, for one.
That's right. But if I still want to get into Zombieland with the kill the zombie game,
exactly.
I have to go and get a certificate from that country in order mm-hmm. to get that in there. That doesn't mean I can't do it. I just have to have the certificate. This is where you upload those certificates to do it. And it doesn't have any relationship to what we're doing right here. And so I would say, in most time, those are left undone, right?
Yeah.
And so now it's down to the fifth one is around cryptography. It's against the law to export cryptography APIs from the United States border. It says, do you have any cryptography? In this case, we do not. And if we did, it would, all kinds of things would happen. But anyway, we do not. And then it asked me, are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. There's no cryptography in this. And then the last, not the last one, but the next one, number 6, is asking for the actual package for me to upload it and present it so it can verify it. So now I'll jump back to Visual Studio, which is waiting here to call me. I'll go ahead and say next. And she'll call me in just a second.
Yeah.
The only girl to call.
And she always gives you a number.
She always gives me her number. I've got a way with computer women. That's right. All right. Sometimes she didn't call right away. Hopefully she calls any second now. Any second now. And I can... Oh, here she is.
There she is.
Here she is. She, you know, she's always yelling at me, too. That's crazy. All right, here we go.
Your code is 3, 2, 3, 8, 2, 7, 9.
Got it. No! Did she hear pause? Just to kind of psych me. She does it every time. I don't know what her deal is. I told her not to.
You're calling all the wrong numbers.
So I'll go ahead and do it. That's that second tier verification. So this is the Windows 8.1 jumpstart that we're doing right now. So I'll go ahead and select it from the list. If it wasn't there and I did this first and didn't go to the site first, I could easily reserve my name here like you did when mm-hmm. you did the presentation. And so I'll go ahead and say next.
Is it that one or wasn't the MVA Scratchpad?
No, there's no MVA Scratch.
Okay.
Oh, no, this is the name that is going to be in the store.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not, you want me to, No. I'm too far along to make changes. I can go back and change the name. How about that?
Sure.
We'll do that. All right, say next here, it'll say, here's where I'm going to put it whenever I'm done. This is version 1.1 of what you're just creating. And here is where I can create multiple builds. Remember mm-hmm. we were talking earlier?
Yep.
Right now I'm going to say any CPU because I'm not using any C++ library or anything else
yep.
that requires me to do it. But I could create explicit builds for x86, for ARM, for x64 right here. I'm not going to do that though because there's no reason to. So I'll go ahead and say create. Just like before, all it's really doing is building, mm-hmm. taking all my binaries, creating a zip file, does it quite quickly,
yeah.
and then
really
also...
It shows the level and depth of the application.
Yeah, it shows how awesome this laptop is to be able to build something like that fast,
yes.
right? And so now I have the option to run validation using the Windows Application mm-hmm. Certification Kit. And right here I can pick a remote machine to run the WAC for me, which is really nice
yep.
because I might need to do this. And I, you know, right now I don't want to do it because it would tie up my machine. But if I had a remote machine I could do it to, then if I had a remote machine that I could do it to, then you know, I would do it much more. And the thing is, the Windows Application Certification Kit gives me the warning in advance that the store is going to reject me,
yes,
or not reject me, right? And so that's the same test that they
it's like
have.
It's like that computer woman that rings you.
Yeah, she's going to reject me. And well, anyway, so that's the certification kit. Right before you submit your app, it absolutely makes sense to launch and run this, mm-hmm, so that you aren't surprised by something that's stupid. Right?
Yes.
That's the idea. And so I'll pop back up here to where it dropped it off. It created a file called AppX Upload. So this is all that I really need. So I'll grab this, go down to Internet Explorer, and I'm just going to drag it inside this little square. It'll take just a second to upload it. It's enormous, 479K.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It does two things. Not only does it upload it, but it also verifies the package. And it goes in and just runs some really simple tests really quickly. One, to make sure I uploaded a package for this app and not for another app by mm-hmm mistake, and some other simple things. And so we can see that it's been uploaded and verified. Everything's all right. That doesn't mean it's ready for the store. That doesn't mean they've certified it. It just means I'm past this one step. So I'll go ahead and click Save. Actually, I'm going to go back in just for a second so you can see it's added it to Windows 8.1. I could have uploaded a Windows 8.0 targeted mm-hmm app that does the same thing. And that means from the user's point of view, it is just one app. And they don't
yeah
they don't see that there's a whole bunch of versions out
yep
there. And I can manage that transparently from the user. So I'm going to go back up to the app name, and I'm going to give it a... let's see, what's the password? Got it. I'm going to go in and give it a different name. So here I'll reserve another name, and we're going to call this, what are we going to call it?
MVA Scratchpad?
MVA. People are going to really download this. Scratchpad. This is going to be nice. It's robust. All right, perfect. There's the MVA Scratchpad. That's what it's going to be called. And so I'll click Save. Oh, I didn't change the primary name. Yeah. I'd have to go back and
you'd
redo
have to go,
it.
It doesn't matter.
I'm not going to do it because
nope
all we're doing is showing it off. Now, you can't skip description. It's very important. And so I have a description for my Windows 8 app, which I didn't upload one. But I also have a description for my Windows 8.1, which I did. Now, it's important. There's about an 80-character minimum. You can't just say, this is my app. Mm-hmm. Something like, this is my app. And, no, you wouldn't want to do that because you want to make your description compelling enough mm-hmm that when users see it, they're going to download it. So something like, use this app to manage your notes, much like the competitors. There you go. That would be possessive. Got it. No problem. Then you would add features. This is just a bullet list to help kind of show it off. So here you could have save notes, barely loses any. Right? That's two features.
That's so definitely a feature.
Definitely a feature. And then right here, as a requirement, I need to upload the screenshot. I took that screenshot, so I'll go ahead and say, see users, Jay Nixon. It's right here at pictures, Windows Simulator. You can see it uploaded it right here. Wait just a second. It uploads it, and I give some sort of comment to say, all your notes
all
in one place. Yeah. Right. Okay, so I can have up to 9. I said 8, I meant 9.
Yeah.
You can have 9 screenshots. Here are notes that I might have. This really makes more sense if this is version 2. I would mm-hmm start kind of
iterate.
Yeah,
it's kind of update notes.
Yeah, you know, I made this change. You might enjoy this new feature. Any kind of hardware recommendations? So nothing yeah specific here, but I could say works best with a pen or something mm-hmm like that. Keywords to help me get found in the store, like notes, note-taking, and any others that I might think are valuable. Right here, copyrights. This is DarenMay. Copyright Darren May 2013. And any additional licensing terms, I might use non-royalty-free images and mm-hmm things like that I need to put credit into. Now, this is promotional images. So specifically, these are images that would go in the store once the store highlights my app and
yep
wants people to download. Now, in this case, it's an unlikely scenario that would happen.
True.
But the reality is they will never highlight my app if I don't provide the promotional image. So I'm going to go ahead and skip that. What's the website? I'll just put my website, jerrynixon.com. What's the support? I'll say it's, I'll just do fake@email.com. I think that'll get me put through. And then privacy policy. And this is a big deal. I have mm-hmm no privacy policy for this because
yeah
I don't talk to the internet. But if I did talk to the internet for any reason, including the advertising SDK, I have to have a privacy policy. This is a URL that goes out to a site either dedicated or reused for my application. If I leave this blank, there's no red dots or red star saying I have to do it, but I'll get rejected guaranteed. I have to have a privacy policy. In this case, I don't, and I'm going to go ahead and change this email because it's kind of fun to think I might actually make it in. Of course I'm not going to make it in. There you go. There's my Microsoft email. I'll say save. And now the very last one is notes to tester. There may be something special that needs to be done. For example, I might need to log into Twitter, might need to log into Facebook, something like that.
Yep.
I can't expect the tester to log in their own Twitter account, their own Facebook account.
You have to provide test accounts.
I have to provide a test account. Look, you have to log in with your Microsoft account. No, you don't, not the tester. They have to log in with your test Microsoft account.
Yep.
No way they're going to use their own. Nothing special. Thanks for your hard work. Maybe that'll get me in a couple hours early. I'll say save. And now you can see the workflow. Every single item down the line is done. All that's left for me to do is to click submit. When I do, it queues it up for immediate automated testing, and then it goes to the developer or goes to the tester for manual testing. I have not put in any of my tax profile information, so I kind of realized this may not actually make it into the store because I'm not going to put my tax profile information into the
USDPA.
Into this test account. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I might put it in another one just for fun. But the idea with tax profile information is if somebody does actually pay $9.99, they've got to pay it to somebody, and it's me they're going to pay it to. And then they've got to report that to Uncle Sam, and so I have to give all my information in order to make any money. If it had all been free, I could have bypassed this requirement, but I had to be a smart aleck about the whole thing. So here you can see the six steps that it has that it will go through. Actually, it will still continue and go all the way through right up to putting into the store. So it can all of these can be done as complete.
Yeah, I mean, you could actually go in and complete your tax information, and if by the time it hits that stage, it'll actually go through.
Right, and I would have plenty of time because there's no way they could. This will take more than, I mean, this will take several days. Doesn't matter that I've got a simple app. It still is in the queue. It still takes a certain amount of time.
Okay. Well, that's really taking us through step by step how we do it. And it's obviously, I think it's intimidating for people who've actually never gone through it. So I think it's very valuable to have really kind of explored step by step. And you can see once you've gone through it a number of times, you actually know if you've got everything lined up and ready to go, it's actually pretty quick moving through.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there, what's great about it, too, is it's transparent without very many surprises. You can run the WAC with, and so and get through really a lot of the problems faster without having to go through this round trip.
Okay. So that really brings us to the end.
All right. I think it does.
Of the essentials course.
I think it does for sure. Let me double check on the slides. That's in.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. All we have is the copyright slide.
Okay, so don't we let's remind people once more to do the survey?
That's right. There's a survey right at the bottom. We're trying to make Guinness Book of World Record highest score of all time. We're kind of excited about that. Don't forget, this is a shout out to ourselves. Tomorrow we're here again. This was the essentials, sort of the basics of XAML development for store apps. Tomorrow is the advanced. And so we go into some more of the more advanced contracts, capabilities and features of the platform. Don't be sure not to miss that. Very exciting.
Absolutely.
All revved up from our previous version of the same course for Windows 8.1.
Yep. We hope you've enjoyed this as much as we've enjoyed delivering it.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll see you tomorrow.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.